In this episode, we talk with Jack Pelton, chairman of the board of the Experimental Aircraft Association, about the status of the FAA reauthorization and air traffic control privatization. Also, the Republic Airways bankruptcy, a WASP celebrates her 106th birthday, and we have a first look at the long-range strike bomber. All that coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 391 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. With me is Rob Mark. He's a pilot, a flight instructor, an aviation journalist, and publisher of the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of things. No wonder I never have any free time anymore.
You're a busy guy.
But hey, welcome from Chicago, where it's only 20 days away from spring.
It feels like it's already arrived. Well, also with us is Brian Coleman. He's our associate producer and the high mileage co-host of this little crew. Brian, hello.
Hey, Max. Yes, I am back in town, but I'm only back for one day. And tomorrow I am back out on the road again.
How many miles do you think you have so far this year?
I haven't looked recently. I'm trying to stay away from being obsessed with this. But I will absolutely close out the first quarter with about 35,000 miles.
A busy little boy.
Yes.
Also with us is Max Trescott. He's a CFI, an author, and a glass cockpit expert. The other Max, Max West.
Hey, Max, and hello to a fellow co-host and listeners around the world. I had great fun yesterday. I was with a client from Germany who wanted to fly around Northern California, so we spent 3.3 hours tooling around all over, and I was live-tweeting photographs because I was able to connect to the internet through my cell phone. So anyway, folks should go out to Max Trescott on Twitter, and you can see a collection of photos from Northern California.
All right, very good. Also with us is our aviation historian, David Vanderhoof. David, how are you?
All right, good. We're ready for a long evening talking about air.
Yes, with two R's.
With two R's.
And to help us with that is our guest this episode, Jack Pelton. Now, Jack, of course, is the chairman of the board for the EAA, the Experimental Aircraft Association. He's the retired chairman, president, and CEO for Cessna Aircraft Company. Jack also worked sometime in the past at Dornier Aircraft in Munich and Douglas Aircraft in Long Beach. Jack was also a member of the board and past chairman of the GAMA, GAMA, the General Aviation Manufacturers Association. And he also served on the board of directors for the NBAA, the National Business Aviation Association. Jack, welcome back to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thanks. It's great to be with you guys again. I was really holding out for episode 393, thinking that was good luck, but 391 is fine. I can go with that.
Close enough. Well, Jack and the EAA, of course, have been heavily involved in the activities surrounding the FAA reauthorization, also known as the House Aviation Innovation Reform and Reauthorization Act, the AIR Act. And we're going to start off with Jack and some conversation about the FAA reauthorization. But first, and really quickly, we just wanted to mention that the dates for the Aviation Geek Fest Seattle 2016 are out. That's going to be Saturday and Sunday, April 9th and 10th, 2016. Now, this has grown to be a huge event for AV geeks who have the opportunity to see some behind-the-scenes action. And this year, they're planning tours of Boeing's Everett and Renton facilities and activities at the Museum of Flight. Now, tickets go on sale at noon Pacific time on March 3rd, 2016. So that's just a day or so away from when you may be listening to this, if it's not too late. If you want to learn more about that event, go to www.airlinereporter.com/AGF for Aviation Geek Fest. All right, with that, is everyone ready to talk about FAA reauthorization?
Ready.
Ready from the West.
Well, the House Aviation Innovation Reform and Reauthorization Act is being put aside for now in favor of a continuing resolution to fund the FAA beyond March 31st, which is when the funding runs out. The chairman of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, Representative Bill Shuster from Pennsylvania, said he's working on the extension bill, but he's also seeking support for the privatization of air traffic control. Jack, maybe you could tell us a little bit about how the EAA views this bill, at least as it came out of committee, and maybe starting with the privatization issue.
Yeah, let's take a just kind of a little rewind of how we got to where we are today. If you go back almost 2 years ago, Congressman Shuster was promoting that we needed to do something bold and dramatic and transformational with when we come up to reauthorizing the FAA. And so part of that was his idea that we would pull the air traffic organization out from under the FAA and put it in essentially a privatized board, if you will, and move all the people, all of the budgets, all of the infrastructure over to this new organization. And while there had been some discussions about doing that, there was some, I think there wasn't a lot of feeling that it would get any momentum. And before you know it, a bill is being proposed for reauthorization. It's in what I'll call a Congressman Shuster's committee's typical fashion, very much a fast track, try to push it through, get the votes and get it get it through the House. And the committee didn't want to give people early look at what was in the bill itself. So they held out to the last day before it went into committee, before we ever saw what was actually being proposed. And then when we saw it, it was, to me, it looked like a very ill-conceived product of trying to create a privatized entity to manage the air traffic control organization that was heavily dominated with board seats controlled by the airlines. And so it became very, very clear that this was a move to cause control of the national airspace system to be governed by the airlines. And then if you put on your tax conservative perspective from a structure as to whether this was going to reduce government and be better for everyone involved, there were really two major misses in that. One, it provided no congressional oversight. So once it went to a privatized board, you were – As a taxpayer and citizen, you were left out in the cold with having a place to go for arbitration. Two, it brought all of the assets that we and our generations ahead of us that have paid in and created that system and handed all of those. And that estimate could be $55 billion of brick and mortar of towers and TRACONs and NAVAIDS and all that would be handed to a private organization, which, again, didn't have congressional oversight. They could sell stuff off. They could do whatever. With that, which was a concern. And then from a tax system, it was very unclear as to how are you going to pay for this system. So when you looked at it, it raised some big questions. While in the initial bill exempting single-engine piston airplanes from user fees, it still begged the question of if you're bringing all of that cost and infrastructure over as is, the controller unions and everything that you have, and you're now going to fund it on your own, where on earth is the money going to come from? Because the airline's whole motivation is not to add cost to their operating system, but to reduce the cost of their operating system. So we looked at that and started wrestling with what could be the unintended consequences of this. And a couple big pieces of that were clearly identified. One, the funding for rural airports would have been at risk if the board decided to focus on the 35 major commercial hub markets, which would be a big blow for general aviation. And then two, the belief that any efforts – and one of the examples that I like to use is when we brought the GPS along, we brought the WAS approaches into play. You know, initially, most of the WAS approaches are really a benefit for the non-major hub airports, the rural airports, the 135 operators, business aviation, recreational aviation use. And if you step back and say, how would we have got in this new structure, how would we have put WAAS into place? If they sat at the board and they said, okay, we're going to divvy up the costs of this new technology, the airlines, quite frankly, would have no interest in implementing WAAS. Because most of them are flying ILS approaches into the major hubs, and their planes aren't necessarily equipped. So you just start looking at some of this, and you say this thing's all going to start to be a house of cards and fall apart over time. Now, in the bill, there were some good, very good things for general aviation. We didn't, you know, we thanked the committee for the new certification rules they put in. That there was the Pilot's Bill of Rights, third class medical exemption that was in there, and there were other things that certainly were beneficial to general aviation. But we think those should have been part of reauthorization with or without privatization. They're non-controversial items that have the ability to stand on their own merit. So we really felt that the privatization piece caused more harm than the benefits of the other items. And we engaged our membership to rally Congress on this, and we've had nothing but absolute strong support, and I think it threw the committee for a loop.
Oh, really? You think that they weren't expecting the reaction that they got?
They were not. I mean, they definitely did, were not. As it went into committee, I was getting personal calls from some of the committee members to have meetings on the subject, and they said, you know, well, what are you guys going to do? And I said, this is exactly what we're going to do. We think privatization is a non-starter. You're not going to get my support and my members' support for this bill as it stands, as long as privatization's in there. And if it is, we're going to unleash our membership to go contact our elected officials and tell them why they think it's such a bad idea. And that definitely set them back.
Hmm. Jack, do you think privatization as a concept is ill-conceived, or is your concern primarily how privatization of air traffic control would be implemented under this bill?
I think both. Under this bill, there wasn't enough there to give you any confidence that there was a path to implementation that would benefit all the stakeholders, ensure public safety, and have a cost structure that made sense. Privatization as a concept, I have yet to see privatization in the other parts of the world do anything but stifle general aviation. People will say, okay, the safety records are somewhat similar, so take that off the table. But go talk to anybody flying in Europe and ask somebody that's trying to take private pilot lessons as to how the cost of being charged for every takeoff and landing and all of the other costs and fees associated with it are just fundamentally make it prohibitive. So basically you're seeing a lot of people doing ultralight and soaring, but you just don't see the type of general aviation activity that we have here in the United States.
But Jack, you know, you mentioned too that as everybody who follows this probably saw, they backed off from this whole privatization thing very, very quickly, considering the length of the hearings. I know Max T and I were online watching those for part of that day, and of course the fellow, I can't think of his name, is it Callio, I think, from A4A? Is it?
Yeah, Nick Callio.
Right. Ed, you know, when they were talking about the representation, he said, hey, listen, I'll be honest, I think the airlines ought to have more. We have more airplanes than anybody else. Or no, not more airplanes, but we funnel more passengers, I believe, than anybody else. And that kind of really set the stage, I think. But do you think it was the outreach from all of the listeners and readers of magazines and everything else that you know, really did the job this time?
I do. And the reason I say that is, and it's not just a feel good answer that I'm giving you. It's based on articles that were in Politico and on the Hill magazine, that they actually highlighted the fact that Schuster had gone out and said, I don't understand why GA isn't going to just roll over and fall in love with this, because they're getting 90%+ of everything they would ever want in this bill. And the Politico fallout was that general aviation spoke up, and that threw some of the members of his committee had him take a big step back, along with our voice getting a number of current congressmen to raise their hand and say, hey, if you guys bring this to the floor, even though you think it's going to pass on a party vote, it's not. We're going to speak up and say, you know, hold the presses. We don't support this. Mike Pompeo from Wichita, Kansas, our congressman from District 4, was clearly one of the ones that took our message and ran with it and ran some op-ed saying why this is bad for general aviation. So I think they wanted to fast track it and just kind of do what normally happens in the House, where people just don't even read the bill and they vote on a party line, and found out they weren't going to get it across the finish line.
Well, good for all of us that sent letters and made phone calls and everything else. I guess it really worked.
It did. There's no, absolutely, again, no doubt in my mind. And it was validated by, you know, those insider, or I shouldn't say they're insider, but the inside the DC Beltway publications like Politico and Hill. I mean, they went on record and stated that was one of the reasons that this bill ended up not getting put to the floor as of yet.
Well, and that's a really good point. Do we expect to see it come back again? I think what I read was that it was being shelved while Schuster continued to look for, you know, additional support. Do you think this is really just kind of temporarily off the shelf and we'll be looking at it again pretty soon?
Here's – when you look at the calendar between now and year end, Congressman Schuster does not like to lose. And I'm guessing he's looking for new strategies and ways to possibly get this thing moving forward. I think that what will be the headwinds he'll be up against is this March 31st deadline of when the FAA's existing budget through a continuing resolution ends, and they need to be put on they either need to get funded through a bill or they need another continuing resolution. So we have, if he can't get anything done before the 31st, then there'll be some sort of continuing resolution which buys some more time. But after July, they're pretty much done till year end, and then there'll be a new Congress. So those are some of the key milestones. Now, at the same time, the Senate is recommending, and they're going into a Commerce Committee meetings in the next week, they are recommending to put a reauthorization bill together that does not have privatization, doing a very short continuing resolution for the FAA, and try to get this bill done before this before this Congress recesses till the end of the year. And so that would be very interesting if the Senate comes up with something that doesn't have privatization, looks good, funds the FAA, and they can try to get it through the Senate. And that will cause the House to have to sit down in committee and conference and come up with, you know, are we going to move this forward or not? They would look pretty foolish if they didn't. So, you know, that's one of the big issues. Part of the problem that we're here, that in this 2 years of the sausage making that led up to this bill, is what was the problem that we're trying to solve? The FAA administrator many times had gone out and talked about what's needed in reauthorization. And it really came down to, we need predictable and stable funding of the FAA to get anything done. And with the last few years, with, we had 23 continuing resolutions from 2006 on, we had sequestration. We gave every excuse from a front funding profile for the FAA to be inefficient and not held accountable to get their job done. And if we could solve for that problem, which is basically reauthorize the FAA with a 5-year funding profile, that takes that issue off the table.
Isn't it kind of a misnomer to even call it privatization? I mean, when I think of privatization, there are great economic arguments to be made for it, and typically a government will sell off the assets to the highest bidder, raise money for the government, and so on. I mean, in this case, if they're giving away $53 billion in assets, why haven't people kind of called out this and said, wait a minute, this isn't privatization. This is the biggest giveaway in government history disguised as privatization.
It really is, and it also, in effect, if you look at just basic economic principles, of which I'm not steeped in that, but I was getting educated over the last few months, you've gone completely away from capitalism as we know it in a competitive free market. You've gone to a really well-entrenched monopoly that then will be able to do whatever it wants, and it is not a nonprofit, because you will have to have a funding source that probably will come through bondholders in other areas that do require a payback, which means you're going to have to earn money. So there's just a lot of principles about it that were very flawed.
Well, in speaking of privatization and user fees, I think we saw AOPA come out and say that they were opposed to user fees, but I don't ever really remember seeing them saying they were opposed to privatization. Don't the two go hand in hand? Is that trying to have your cake and eat it too, to support privatization without user fees?
I think their strategy was, let's not talk about the privatization side of it for whatever reason they want, but let's stay focused on no fees. I think they understood that the airlines were not going to allow Part 135 operations to go with no fees, because that would be a direct competitor for the first class passengers. And you know, if that got a pass, that weakens the airline's position. So that's just a strategy they employed. But I like you, was looking at it kind of at the higher level, which is, okay, no user fees. And if they tell you there aren't going to be any user fees, that's interesting. But at the end of the day, you've got to fund this system. And there would probably never be any guarantees that you would never be subjected to some form of participation financially if you're going to use the system.
I think I read in Canada that not only are they paying user fees there, but they're still continuing to pay the fuel tax, which is how we've traditionally been funding. Do we run the risk of having to pay both just like they're doing?
That's certainly a risk. I mean, the other problem would be there was no doubt we'd still be paying the fuel tax. But now that you don't have congressional oversight of the system, I don't know how you prevent runaway taxes on the fuel tax if that's how you're going to have to make the books balance at the end of the year. So the controls and the checks and the balance were just not in place to ensure any kind of safety net, if you will, for general aviation or recreational aviation.
Tell us a little bit about the government advocacy team at EAA and, you know, who you're working with there and what kinds of things that you're doing behind the scenes on this bill.
Well, we have Doug McNair from EAA is resident in D.C., and he's our voice and legs on the ground in D.C. And then we have, through our board and membership and companies that are part of EAA, we have just a lot of volunteered talent and capability, along with a small staff that is really engaged at some pretty high levels. I mean, I don't want to throw their names and specifically who they know and where they go, but on this subject, there was nonstop phone calls and meetings, and you know, we had a map of states and who knew which congressmen and which senators, and on a personal level that we were able to get in front of, which, you know, is pretty effective grassroots. I think you used the term earlier, just, you know, wearing out the shoe leather in the halls of Congress, and it's a very effective way of doing that. I attended, you know, many sessions with many congressmen that, and in those meetings, there was just a very, very high level support from industry in not wanting this bill to go forward.
Let's spend just a little bit more time talking about some of the things that we see in the bill that we do like. Jack, you mentioned a few. Max T, I think you see some things in this the bill that came out of committee that are encouraging to you.
Well, like Jack talked about some of them, and some of them are in the EAA's press release that came out a couple of days ago. So medical reform, Part 23 aircraft certification, and also a home building as a permitted use for airport hangar use. Jack, can you tell us about each of those?
Yeah, let's start with the Part 23 certification rewrite. There was there's been a lot of effort by the manufacturers to take the Part 23 rule and kind of scale it so that if you're building if you're trying to certify a new airplane like a Cessna 172, that the rules for that performance base of an airplane would be considerate of what's necessary from a safety standpoint, as opposed to adding all of the rules that are necessary under Part 23 to certify a Citation CJ3. In today's Part 23 environment, they're both subject to the same rules. So there was some effort to try to change that guidance so that it would encourage more development and certification of new products at the lower end. Some great work in that area. There was in the bill ensuring funding for PAFI, which is the program that's looking at what will be the replacement fuel for 100 low lead down the road in 2020 or some other time period. Making sure that funding stayed in the FA, which You know, it's there today. Some of these are what would have normally occurred under any reauthorization of the FAA. The FAA third class medical exemption was a little more liberal than what the Pilot's Bill of Rights 2 that came out of the Senate. But the good news is that both the House and the Senate recognize there's something we can do better with medical reform. And I'm convinced, being that the Senate passed a bill already and the House elected to hold it hostage with this FAA reauthorization to try to get us to agree to privatization. So that was in there. You know, all of those, I think, are good legislation that stands on its own merit, and that without privatization, we'll get those done. I don't see anybody having any objection to that.
But Jack, let me ask you now, the point is that when this goes to the Senate, all of these other provisions that we just spoke about, medical reform and the Part 23 issue and all that, they won't necessarily be in this new piece of legislation the Senate is looking at. So how does that work in terms of who picks up the banner again for FAA medical reform or the Part 23 issue and kind of carries that through?
You will see that all of the associations have kind of have a divide and conquer based on issue. We don't have to discuss the medical reform because the Senate has already passed a bill on that. So we'll make sure, saying, look, you guys already unanimously agreed to something. Let's just make sure that's part of the bill. GAMA will be working hard on the Part 23 certification activity. I'll be there next week meeting with the various senators in the Commerce Committee, who I know personally, to go through letting them know what are the important parts of what was proposed in the House that we want to make sure get included in whatever is created as a Senate bill, and get the what we're going to do is we're going to take the approach that the House bill is dead, set it over to the side, take the pieces of all that we liked, and make sure that in a new bill out of the Senate as it gets created, that those elements are included in there on day one.
And don't rush it through so quickly that nobody can read it.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Jack, is there something that we should all be doing right now? Is there a call to action for us, or are we in a sort of a wait and on a hold until the next steps occur?
In talking to a town hall on Saturday, I made clear that everybody should understand that this bill in the House did pass committee. The only thing it hasn't happened is that the leadership is not elected to take it to the floor for a vote. And that could still happen. So you can't assume that it's dead. You have to continue to reach out to your, if for some reason you didn't reach out on our Rally Congress site to Congress, continue to do so, because we need to make sure that we continue to let people in Congress know that we are not supportive of this bill as the way it was constructed. And you have to continue to be that voice until this thing officially gets replaced by an FAA reauthorization bill at some point in time. That meets our satisfaction. So it's never over until the bill that we want gets approved through the House and Senate.
The EAA rally site, what's that?
Yeah, Rally Congress. If you go to EAA.org, there's a link we're on our advocacy page it's called Rally Congress, and it's it has you put in your zip code that you live in, and it pulls up who your congressmen are in that area where you live, your congress, single congressperson that lives, and a pre-formatted letter that you put your name and address, and it populates it and sends it directly to your congressman.
Perfect.
How many of those have been sent out so far?
Ooh, I don't have the – you got me on that one. I didn't check to see what the it's well over a couple thousand that I'm aware of.
Hey, Jack, I was always wondering, do those pre-formatted letters really make a difference versus a custom-written letter? You know, do they have the same impact?
Good question. And let me answer that. We really believe that the pre-formatted letters, at least from a letting the staffers who then have to brief the congressman know the weight of how many of their constituents are weighing in on this issue. So when the inbox gets loaded up, they can say, look, Mr. Congressman or Mrs. Congressman, we got people coming in from our district really weighing in on this. They recognize that a lot of people don't have the understanding of how to write the letter and get the facts in there. So they accept that. And then we always encourage, if you have a personal relationship or you want to put a different twist on it, to send in personalized letters also, or actually just make the call. They count calls. So when you go visit your congressperson, there's somebody there that when you call in and say, I want to let Congressman Mike Pompeo from Wichita, Kansas, know that I am absolutely against this bill, they track that. And then when they have their morning briefs, they're looking at the record to see where's their district on this topic. Hmm.
Jack, is all this activity, is this taking away from your focus on preparing for AirVenture this summer?
No.
And how is that coming along? We're really looking forward to that.
Yeah, it is coming along very, very well. We meet every week, and we are going through what we call our lineups of what planes are going to come and what are going to be our theme features. This year, it's the 100th anniversary of Boeing. It's the anniversary, and I say anniversary in the sense of a date certain. It's not something that you are celebrating, but it's Gulf War, Pearl Harbor. So we're going to have Gulf War themed day with Gulf War aircraft that participated in the Gulf War for the military there. We're going to have a Pearl Harbor day where we have a lot of the airplanes types that were at Pearl Harbor, including the actual Interstate Cadet that was in the air. Flying during when the invasion occurred, and that airplane has been restored and will be in the air at AirVenture. We're going to have a day focused around World War I aircraft, where we hope to have about eight replica airframes, but with period black engines that will run different types of rotary engines and flying. Just a lot of great stuff starting to line up for AirVenture that we're very excited about. Some stuff we haven't released yet until we get stuff firmed up, but it's lining up real well.
Very good. I think I know we've had a lot of conversation amongst our listeners talking about AirVenture this year, making plans for it. I've seen in our listener team forum a number of folks talking about where should they stay, should they camp, should they do this, and then they're all helping each other and having a great conversation about that. So the camaraderie and all of that is already taking place, well before the event this July. So. It's really great to see.
Yeah, it's exciting. We had a couple weeks ago, we had our annual ski plane fly-in there at Pioneer Field, the grass strip at EA headquarters. And there was ample snow and a great turnout and the chili feed. And a lot of people showed up, probably over 1,000 people showed up, about 35 airplanes, but a lot of drive-in traffic. And when you see everybody get together and you're in the hangar with them, it was what I called kind of the light switch turning on that the next major event will be AirVenture in July. But to see that enthusiasm of people already thinking about it and asking questions is just great.
Fantastic. All right. Well, Jack, we want to thank you for spending a little bit of time with us talking about some of these issues. And we know that you're very, very busy these days. And we really appreciate, obviously, all that you and many others are doing to represent the aviation community and work these issues hard. So we really, really appreciate it and thank you.
Well, thank you. You guys do such a great job in the show. It's great to be a part of it, and hope to be talking to you again soon, maybe closer to AirVenture when we start talking about some of the more specifics about what people can come see and enjoy and expect out of a week in Oshkosh.
Very good. Thanks a lot.
All righty. Take care, guys.
Hey, we'll see you, Jack.
Thanks, Jack. All right.
Let's continue on with a couple of more news items. Just quickly, we should mention this item with the Republic Airways. We have an article in Forbes, Republic Airways CEO says bankruptcy filing will take airline to new heights. And what we have here is Republic Airways, a regional carrier. They filed for protection under Chapter 11 of the United States Bankruptcy Code. And they say factors include things like labor disputes and pilot shortages causing them to cancel flights, resulting in loss of revenue and poor earnings. Maybe we should explain bankruptcy just a little bit, because it's different in the U.S. than in some other countries. In some countries, Bankruptcy means liquidation. And in the U.S., it can mean liquidation. That's under Chapter 7. But we also have this thing called Chapter 11. And the view is that sometimes it's in the greater public good for the company to reorganize and survive. So there's a process for doing this. That's what Republic is going through now. There's a petition filed with a bankruptcy court. There's a reorganization plan that's developed. A trustee is appointed to monitor the reorganizations. The creditors are involved. And in the end, the judge has to approve the reorganization plan. And usually also the debtors have to approve it as well. The point is, as we've seen with other airlines, sometimes it's I guess you could say convenient way to shed a lot of costs, reorganize your company, kind of start over again. One of the debates is always, should we let that happen or should we just let the airline cease operations because they couldn't compete? We'll see what happens here. Republic is going to continue its operations, it says, while it's in this process of Chapter 11, employees will get paid, flight operations will continue.
Yeah, what I found interesting about this is it doesn't seem like, they fly for Delta, American, and United, and they only cited canceled flights with Delta due to pilot shortage. So I was just curious as to how they allocate their pilots in order to only have it affect one of the three airlines that they're flying for.
My guess is it probably had something to do with the airplanes that they were flying for Delta. As I understand it, Republic had a bunch of ERJ 135s, I think, that were, the 50 or, the smaller regional jets that they wanted to get rid of. And I think they were also flying some Dash 8s of some version. I don't know if they were the Q400s or whatever. But they wanted to get rid of those. Now, whether those are the ones that were flying on the Delta side, I don't know. That would be my guess, though, as to why they were, kind of affecting that area. But, in terms of should they be able to do it, hey, come on, let's face it. Look at the IRS tax code. During a political season here in the United States, we always hear the conservative side of the economy talk about how highly taxed we are corporately here in the United States, except that what they don't tell you is that most of the corporations don't pay those high taxes because they take, they're smart enough to have great accountants and take advantage of the tax code and the loopholes in the tax code. They keep money outside the United States. There's a million ways to do it that, yes, you can complain about the taxes, but that doesn't necessarily mean you pay them. So in this sense, bankruptcy is there, and if the people at Brian Bedford was smart enough to say, look, guys, we don't have any choice. We've got to get rid of these old airplanes, and nobody wants them, and if this is a way out, then it's either that or we wait until we close the doors. I don't know. I don't really have a problem with that myself.
I kind of wonder why an airline like SkyWest is doing well when you consider both of these regional airlines are probably using the same capacity purchase model that's used where the majors come in and say, well, we're going to pay, so many dollars per seat or whatever the formula is. Why is it that SkyWest somehow is making money under a similar type agreement and Republic is not? And I just kind of wonder if it goes back to the aircraft mix that you're talking about. We know that the 50-seaters are incredibly expensive to run they're the same cost as a 70-seater, but you get that much more revenue.
Well, I think that's an interesting point. It's too bad we don't have our airline geek guy here. What was his name again? That kid that we brought up, and then as kids do, they go away from home. They never call. They never write. But I think SkyWest is a whole lot bigger than Republic, if I'm not mistaken. And when you have a huge fleet, you can get deals with carriers that you can't get. That's my guess as to one reason that might have happened. But Maybe somebody else has a better idea.
And I read a comment somewhere about the pilot pay at Republic, which implied that they're paying less than, you know, for example, what SkyWest is paying. Now, I don't know that, that's the case, but, you know, I think what we've seen is it's really hard to attract pilots if you're not willing to pay competitively.
All right, let's move on. And our next item, this is kind of a fun one. This is sort of good news. This is a birthday, actually. This comes from Village Life, and this is about Doris Lochness. And she was one of those, if you recall from our conversation about the WASPs, she was one of those 1,074 women who were accepted to join the Women's Air Force Service pilots that ferried aircraft during the Second World War. Well, Doris just celebrated her 106th birthday. So we want to give a shout out to Doris, not only for her service as a pilot, but for just congratulating her on her 106th birthday.
Yeah, can we get Rob to sing happy birthday to her?
That might not be a good idea.
I could do that!
No.
Yeah, I think part of her accomplishment was kind of amazing that she was also, the 55th woman to earn her commercial helicopter license.
Yes.
So
yes.
Not only was she flying airplanes, she was flying helicopters too.
There's a quote from her. This is from an interview that she was recently in, and she said, quote, "I wasn't young, but I had four children to take care of. Once they were all in school, I'd do the fastest housework you ever saw, then hop on my bike to rush to that little airport." I think that's just amazing. What happened to Doris after the war? Well, you know, she continued in aviation. She worked as a flight instructor. She was a sightseeing pilot, and she also performed in air shows in a Volte Stinson called Swamp Angel. David, are you familiar with that airplane, the Volte Stinson?
No.
Okay.
Stinson and Volte are two manufacturers. I've never heard of a Volte Stinson or a Stinson Volte.
I think maybe one bought the other. I'm really not sure. So maybe we can look into that. But she flew that. She bought it as a war surplus airplane. And apparently she had that until she was 90. So again, happy birthday to Doris Lochness.
Well, and Wikipedia says that Stinson later became a division of Volte. I'd never heard the two of them associated together before either.
Okay. All right, another item from CNN. This is Air Force reveals first image of B-21 long-range strike bomber. And this is an artist rendering based on the initial design concept. This was shown by the Air Force Secretary, Deborah Lee James. And the B-21, David, this looks an awful lot like a B-2.
Well, it actually looks like the prototype B-2, if you go back even further. The B-2 was modified for low-level penetration, and the B-21, Northrop, when they won the contract, now that Boeing has stopped suing them, was based on very mature technology, supposedly. Well, you can see how mature the technology is. Looks like we're going to get another 100 B-2s. We're just waiting more. They're cheaper, faster, and better, but they're literally based on the B-2 technology. The interesting part about it is, part of the technology is the B-21 might be optionally manned, terms that Rob Marks and Max Trescott don't like hearing, meaning that you don't need no stinking pilots.
Hey, don't let me in with Rob there. I like drones.
Yeah,
David, is this some of the technology advances that they made in the 19 iterations between the B-2 and the B-21? What happened to all those numbers?
I don't know. The Air Force doesn't do the rules anymore. It really should be a B-3, but I don't know why they got... I think B-21 came from 21st century bomber, but who knows? The Air Force designation system's been thrown out the window. Why do we have a KC-46? It is. What's really interesting, though, is the Secretary of Air Force is looking for people to provide a name for it. Now, I personally don't think you can beat Spirit. I always sort of kind of liked that name for two reasons. One, it was Spirit as in ghost, and
All of those aircraft are named Spirit of Pennsylvania, Spirit of Missouri, Spirit of... So
these are the B-2s you're talking about, right?
The B-2s, yeah. Yeah, so yeah. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what they come up with for the B-21. It's not going to be a bird. I always liked Excalibur, and that was supposed to be for the B-1, but that never got picked up. So it'll be interesting to see what they pick up for the name. And if you notice, that drawing really has very little detail to it from cockpit to engines. And if you go back and look at the initial line drawings for the B-2, it's very similar. So other than it has less cutouts than the B-2 on the trailing edge of the wing.
A couple of months ago, I asked F-117 program designer Alan Brown about this airplane, and he said before the drawings came out, it's going to look just like the B-2 because you can't improve upon that design. And I was really stunned. I was just stunned that he would come up with a statement like that. But anyway, I think B-21 is probably a misprint. I think what they mean is it's a B-2.1. That's the software version of this airplane.
Well, that could be, too. The interesting thing about the B-2 was it was the same wingspan as the YB-49. And when they showed it to Jack Northrop before he passed, they showed him that it was dimensionally the same size wing as the original B-49, B-35, his flying wings. Hmm. So this is going to be smaller, I believe. And it's going to be slightly faster, and it's going to use less fuel and have longer range. So you're right, Max. It is kind of 2.1, B2.1. So, yeah, who knows why they came up with B-21. But it'll be interesting to see what names the Air Force will come up with and how. And I don't think Batarang will be at the top of the list.
Batarang.
Well, if I can throw in a plug for just a minute, over at Jetwine, Scott Spangler wrote about this today, actually. And he had an interesting perspective on why we should look at some of the airplanes that Boeing has already built as a basis for the B-21, and use some of the technology that already exists and produce something that would be an improved B-52 of sorts. And so I would invite, I'm not going to tell everybody what's in the story. You got to just go read it. And if you don't agree with Scott, you can tell him so. But I actually thought it was kind of an interesting perspective.
Oh, cool. All right, we'll take a look at that. We'll put a link to that in the show notes so people are sure to be able to find that easily. But I'm sure they can find that at jetwine.com. And now here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian, with the airplane of the week.
Thanks, Max. Only every 4 years can I do a leap year history segment. I have a book review for the Smithsonian, and I have a plan to educate Rob on the Atlas China, but that's in the weeks ahead. So I do want to thank Glenn for his EE Lightning segment last week. It was nice having a week off, especially when all of our other co-hosts decided to abandon the show.
Oh, sorry.
There are interceptors like the Lightning, and then there are Mach 3 interceptors like the YF-12A. But what does the YF-12 have to do with February 29th? Well, it was February 29th, 1964, that President Lyndon Johnson announced the existence of the YF-12 as a way to keep hidden the Central Intelligence Agency's Oxcart program. When is a Blackbird not a Blackbird? Well, when it's an A-12. The YF-12 is the brother to the SR-71. It grew out of the A-12 Archangel CIA program. The original A-12s were single-seat aircraft. Keep in mind the A-12 was a direct replacement of the U-2. In September of 1959, the United States Air Force canceled the F-108 Rapier by North American Aviation. The Mach 3 Plus Rapier was going to replace the F-102 and F-106s. The Rapier used technologies for being simultaneously used for the XB-7 Valkyrie. With the cancellation, the U.S. Air Force brass brought a fairly mature Hughes AN-ASG-18 radar system and the GAR-9 missile to Lockheed to be adapted to the A-12, thus creating the AF-12. With a letter of intent and a check for $1 million, It was presented to the Skunk Works for three prototypes of the AF-12 in October 1960. The A-12 airframe number 7 was earmarked to become the AF-12 prototype. The Q-bay of the A-12, where all the camera equipment was stored, would become a second cockpit for the FCO, or fire control officer. Interestingly, the rear cockpit would look almost identical to what was proposed for the F-108. The chines of the A-12 were cut back to make room for the large fire-controlled radar. The bulbous nose carried a 48-inch Doppler dish for the ASG-18 radar system. The radar modification caused all sorts of lateral stability issues in wind tunnel testing. The results were ventral strakes under each engine and a large folding fin, which would drop down upon retraction of the landing gear. On August 7, 1963, the first AF-12 took to the skies at Groom Lake. Pilot James Ethem flew the uneventful mission. Testing continued through the fall of 1963, with the prototype 1002 joining testing at Groom Lake. All this time, the CIA was flying their A-12s from the same facility. On February 29, 1964, it was decided that President would announce that the AMI existed to continue to provide cover for the A-12 program. Johnson announced the A-11, a typo of AMI, the Advanced Manned Interceptor. Within 24 hours, 1001 and 1002 were flown from Area 51 to Area Edwards Air Force Base. They flew a very direct runway-to-runway flight, were immediately directed into hangars without letting the Pratt & Whitney J-58s cool, the resulting in the fire suppression system going off and some of the ground crew almost drowning. With the announcement, the Air Force gave the new fighter an official designation of YF-12A. It wasn't until September 1964 the media were permitted to see the aircraft, then without cameras. After the directional stability issue was solved, came another more unique problem. How do you fire a missile at 3,300 feet per second ground speed? On April 16, 1964, 1002 dropped the first AIM-47, which was renamed from the GAR-9. AIM, for those who don't know, stands for Air Intercept Missile. The AIM-47 was a growth of the AIM-4 Falcon. It was 800 pounds with a nuclear warhead. While the separation was successful and proved you could deploy a missile at 70,000-plus feet at Mach 3+, the crew was lucky that it didn't have a motor, because if it had fired, it would have flown directly into the cockpit. The AIM-47 had a range of 115 miles and flew to a speed close to Mach 6. Eventually, both articles were sent to Tyndall Air Force Base. The YF-12A AIM-47 scored an impressive 6 out of 7 kills. The attack by the YF-12 used to be always from above. All but those two scores, 6 out of 7, were from 74,000 plus feet or higher. They also occurred at launch speeds of Mach 3 plus. On May 1, 1965, the YF-12 set a world speed record of 2,070.101 miles per hour and an altitude record of 80,258 feet. These records would only be beaten by an SR-71 later. On the 14th of that month, the United States Air Force ordered the F-12B, an initial quantity of 93 airframes for ADC, or the Air Defense Command. However, the world's greatest jackass of a Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, delayed procurement for 3 years to divert the funding for the Vietnam conflict. By that time, it was clear the bomber gap and the Soviet Union supersonic bombers were not the threat they were originally perceived to be. The order was canceled in January of 1968. The first YF-12A, 60-6934, was damaged by a ground fire due to a landing mishap on August 14, 1966. Later, it was combined with a static test frames front. It would go on to serve as the only SR-71C 6419781, a two-seat trainer for the SR-71 program. The second, 60-6936, was lost when it suffered a fuel starvation from a faulty fuel line on June 24, 1971. However, both crews survived the ejection. Lastly, 6935, the third YF-12, continued to serve with NASA until it was retired to the National Museum of the United States Air Force in Dayton on November 17, 1979. In 1969, NASA and the United States Air Force began using the YF-12 as a testing aircraft. From 69 to 79, the YF-12s flew every week for those years. To replace NASA 936, the United States Air Force gave them YF-12C 617951. The YF-12C actually was the second SR-71A, but to avoid a political upheaval that a civilian organization had a strategic reconnaissance aircraft, it was redesignated. Eventually, that aircraft was returned to the United States Air Force. The most famous experiment for the YF-12 was Cold War. A large supercooled cylinder was lowered into the aircraft's slipstream at Mach 3+. Sensors collected friction temperatures and compared to theoretical wind tunnel modeling. NASA also coordinated with the United States Air Force to provide data for the upcoming B-1A bomber. Data brought about by the YF-12A flight testing is still used today for hypersonic research. The YF-12 will again be displayed at the National Museum of the United States Air Force with the opening of the new hangar in June featuring research and development aircraft. It should be noted that the lessons learned from the YF-12A led to the improvements to the A-12, which became the RS-71, but that's another story. So, a leap year aircraft that sort of was a leap ahead of anything then and still, and to this day, my favorite variant of the Archangel family. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Thank you, David. Boy, tell us how you really feel about McNamara.
I hate McNamara. The man was a bean counter. Kennedy's biggest mistake was McNamara.
Oh, dear.
With apologies, of course, to anybody who's in the bean counting profession.
Yeah, and all the descendants of McNamara.
That's right.
I thought his choice on Marilyn Monroe was okay.
The F-111, A-7, the man just did not understand military programs. And you know, the F-111 is a prime example of McNamara's folly. And the problem we now have with the F-35, getting an aircraft to do everything, and just because the Air Force wanted it meant that the Navy needed to have it, kind of thing. And
Do you think we learned the lesson?
No.
No. And no. So whose folly is the F-35? Do we have someone to pin that on?
The manufacturer. You can't pwn it. No, I mean.
Well, you can if they use the strategy of putting contracts in every congressional district to get support. I mean that's just unconscionable.
It is, and the F-35 sort of came out of something else. McNamara wanted every program to be cross-utilized. I mean, the F-35 is a really bad example of an aircraft trying to do everything at one time. I know that I have a lot of faith in it that it will figure that out, but I don't know. McNamara, just every program he touched for various reasons, you know, he can't, like tonight, the YF-12 being canceled because he wanted to divert funds to the Vietnam War. And if he didn't like a program, he'd find some way to screw it up just so it would go away. Kennedy wanted the best and the brightest, and McNamara was a brilliant man. He just should not have been Secretary of Defense.
All right. Up now, we have another edition of Rob's On the Mark segment. This one is titled, How Airports Can Help Revitalize the Aviation Industry. Rob, do you want to say anything before we get started with this?
Only one thing. I just hope airport managers around the world are listening to this. Roll 'em, Max.
I'm Rob Mark, and this is On the Mark. I was running through one of the FAA databases the other day and discovered that we have just over 19,000 landing areas in the United States. That includes big airports, of course, like O'Hare and Los Angeles and Seattle. But there are also thousands of smaller regional and reliever fields, not to mention heliports and seaplane bases. Now, they all have one thing in common. They represent a place where airplanes and helicopters and people all gather together from time to time. Now, if we see these places only as landing areas, though, I think we're doing the industry a huge disservice, especially since our economy is still struggling. But first, a bit of context on that. In the early 1980s, this country produced about 15,000 piston airplanes annually. Last year, that number was less than 1,000. In the 1980s, the FAA register listed about 700,000 pilots. Today, that number's hovering in the high 500,000s and still declining. Did you know that nearly 7 out of 10 student pilots quit before they ever earn a pilot certificate? But it's not just pilot starts that worry me. The number of aviation maintenance technicians has been flat since the 90s, and that's compounded by the fact that 75% of those AMTs today are over the age of 50. As an industry, our ship's been taking on water for some time, despite a number of conscientious national initiatives, most of which haven't honestly moved the needle very much. If we don't figure out, though, how to start bringing more new people into the industry soon, we're going to run short of people to fly and repair the airplanes we do build, and we're going to watch more and more airports turn into ghost towns. Too many people, though, still seem to believe this is all someone else's problem. What if we started focusing our triage locally, like at our neighborhood airports? When people think of learning to fly, they go to the airport. If they want to buy a plane, they often visit the local airport first. When they need an airplane repaired or they're thinking about an aviation career, they often head to the local airport to see some real examples of what they've probably uncovered on the internet. But the airport managers who operate these landing areas are seldom involved in any of this. Their world seems to be just keeping the pavement in shape and the runway lights on. Helping to market the industry? It's probably not even on their list. But why would it be? Airport managers aren't trying to think about marketing. But what if airport managers did see their role a bit differently? In fact, what if we all did? What if we all started working together to help our local airport managers transform their facilities into industry beacons? Resources where airport personnel helped market flight and AMT schools and helped organize career days or community events or taught people how to safely operate all those drones they got last holiday season. Now, I know many airport managers are probably groaning about now, but I'm not suggesting they do all the work themselves. But what if airport managers did see their facilities as the core of an industry resource? What if airport managers encouraged and supported a Young Eagles rally every few months? What if they encouraged and supported a career day each fall, or helped pitch those reduced price introductory flights for those people yearning to explore the sky? Airport managers could encourage people to supply the content for the airport's Facebook or Instagram pages for the entire neighborhood to take a look at. Imagine if they took the lead to organize a monthly community breakfast that all the airport tenants pitched in with to help. Heck, before we know it, we might start convincing people near our airports to ignore those 8-foot-high barbed wire fences with the signs that say, "Keep out, federal offense." And they might actually stop in for a visit. So airport managers everywhere, our industry's in trouble. If you'll help us, we'll help you, because this kind of co-op marketing is good for everybody on the field. But unless we just stop talking about getting more people in aviation, including airport managers, we may soon find that many of their landing areas start turning into parks. Now, in case you have another thought, please feel free to email me here. And of course, from Chicago, I'm Rob Mark. Thanks for watching. And don't forget to pass around your link to On the Mark. We'll see you next time.
All right, very good. We'll have a link to the video, which is the source for that, on the website in the show notes for this episode. Rob, this is a really great point. What made you kind of think of this topic? Anything specific?
Probably because I have worked with a number of airports over the years, and I think they miss the opportunity. I think it's kind of a shame. I mean, you look at what's going on at Santa Monica, and the town there sees their airport as an obstruction, as just something that's getting in the way of progress.
And if the people that owned the airport, the towns and cities, saw them as something to be developed as they would, let's say, if it was a real estate project of some other sorts, they'd be all for it. But because they don't really understand it, they just kind of say, well, I don't know. Let the airport manager deal with it. And airport managers don't normally come equipped ready to help market an airport or communicate with the community, and they need that. And so everybody kind of says, I hope somebody does it. And I don't see anybody doing it. We all complain about it, but I just think there's that resource there that we could use if we offer them some help and not just throw it on their backs and say, go fix it. You know, that's just my thought.
Yeah. No, that's good. Thanks for bringing that out. And I'm glad we were able to play that episode of On the Mark. All right. So let's move ahead. And we actually have a kind of a sad note, don't we, Max T?
We did. I just got an email a few hours ago about this. There'll be a lot of folks out there in the aviation community who came through San Jose State University, which was under the chairmanship of Thomas E. Leonard for nearly 50 years. And I'm sad to report that he passed away over the weekend. I believe he was 93. He was started very, very early on with the university, and that was after working for Pan Am Airways. He was an aeronautical engineer working on the China Clipper out of Pan Am's base at Treasure Island here in the San Francisco area back in 1942 and 43, and then served in the U.S. Army Air Force for a couple of years. Went on to lead the department. And in fact, he kind of virtually, started the aviation department at San Jose State. So anyway, he's won a number of awards. He won the Elder Statesman Award from the NAA back in 2004. He also won the Crystal Eagle Award 2 years ago from the Aero Club in Northern California. He affected the lives literally of thousands of graduates who went through that program. So for those of you who went through that program and are familiar with Tom Leonard, I just wanted to let you know that that a great man has passed on.
Hmm. All right. Thank you for that. All right. Moving on to listener mail. We heard from Tom. Tom sent us a link to a video. It's a trailer, actually. It's called Bring Right Footed to Your Community. Now, Right Footed is a documentary. It's a film about Jessica Cox. You may have read about her in the press and the media. She was the first woman without arms to fly an airplane. And this film is apparently available for screenings in movie theaters or in group settings. And I guess we have the opportunity to bring this film to our communities if we'd like to. You can learn more about that at rightfootedmovie.com. And there's a link you can click there called Host a Screening. Meanwhile, we'll put this the trailer for this in the show notes. We also got some voicemail feedback from our friend Jeff Ward. He was listening to episode 387, where we were talking with Greg Brown about some of the things that he had done. And Jeff noted that we didn't really spend very much time at all talking about Greg's amazing photography. So he sent along this message.
Hello, airplane geeks. This is Jeff Ward from Team UCAP, a longtime Airplane Geeks listener from the days of Courtney and Max. Just wanted to send some feedback on episode 387 with your guest, Greg Brown. As always, very much enjoyed the podcast. You guys do a great job. Just wanted to say something about Greg. You covered a lot of territory as far as Greg's aviation experience and background and his work as a instructor and the recognition he's gotten for that, his work as a columnist and a book author, and then finally his most recent work with the Facebook Student Pilot Pep Talk page, which is tremendous. I think that's a great effort there. But one aspect of Greg's aviation work that didn't seem to get mentioned at all is his aviation photography. Greg's a renowned photographer, and has just taken beautiful, beautiful landscapes, mostly in the Southwest, but not confined to there, from the flying carpet. And he sells his photography, beautifully printed and mounted. He's had exhibitions and just seemed a shame to omit that. I know you had a lot of territory to cover, but I wanted to point that out and point people to Greg's website, you know, Greg Brown Flying Carpet. Take a look. He's got some just beautiful work, and you can have some of it for your own if you want. In fact, I own one of Greg's prints. A couple of years ago, Greg donated two of his prints to AOPA for one of their online fundraising auctions. And I was bidding on the larger of the two until the bidding went out of my price range. And so I bid on the smaller print, and I won it. And Greg and I exchanged emails at that time regarding shipping instructions and so forth. And one day, I was had just come out of the local post office here in town, and my cell phone rang, and it was Greg Brown calling to clear up one last piece of information about shipping instructions. And don't you know, about 30, 35 minutes later, we finally got off the phone. We talked about aviation and instruction and the future of aviation and where I might go with aviation in the future and whether I might become an instructor and how we get more people into aviation and just fairly wide-ranging conversation about things. And it was just sort of anecdotal about what a just a generally nice guy Greg is, how passionate he is about aviation, how generous he is with his time when it comes to sharing that passion. So I just wanted to share that information and make sure people were aware of Greg's photography and how great it is. And maybe you can own a piece of it for yourself. Anyway, that's all I had to say. Thanks again for the great work on the podcast. Love everything you're doing. And I'm also a listener of the UAV Digest as a both a private pilot and a longtime radio control flyer. That's all I wanted to say this time, except for Rob, thanks again for lunch at Oshkosh last year, and hope to see you there again this year. That's it. Jeff Ward signing off.
Well, thanks, Jeff. I'm really glad that Jeff brought that up because, you know, sometimes it's frustrating that, you know, some of our guests are obviously multi-talented and we don't always have enough time or opportunity to sort of explore all aspects of that. And Greg Brown is certainly an amazing photographer. We did use a photo of him standing in front of some of his images for the post for the episode. I think that was, let's see, yeah, 387. So if you visit airplanegeeks.com/387, you can find our conversation with Greg Brown, see one example of some of his photographs, and certainly visit his site, gregbrownflyingcarpet.com, to see more of it. It's really fantastic stuff.
And it's really great to see that Rob's going to buy us all lunch when we meet up at Oshkosh.
Thanks, Rob. Really appreciate it.
Well, I suckered people into doing that last year, and boy, I'll tell you, I just did it out of quirky thought, and I'll tell you, we had to do it 2 days in a row because we had so many people show up, and boy, who said there's no free lunch, huh? But who knows what will happen this year?
Quirky? You? No.
Yeah. That's why you guys have to be there this year.
Let's see. Chris sent us an email. He wrote to us and said, in consideration of your recent podcast on WASP, I thought you might be interested in the following. So he's got a little story here. It's not too long. He says, I recently visited the former Cornelia Fort Air Park located in Nashville, Tennessee. This was named after Cornelia Fort, a prominent female aviator from Nashville who became the first WAFS, Women Auxiliary Ferrying Squadron, precursor to the WASP, fatality in 1943. Now, he says the site was a general aviation airport in use from 1944 until the historic floods of May 2010. The airport is located adjacent to a river bottom and was submerged during that flood event. In 2011, the airport was handed over to the city as an extension of its park system. Walking paths and parking areas make for easy access, and the taxiway and runway make for a semi-popular cycling and walking spot. He says there is a historical plaque and a small display honoring Cornelia Fort and describing the history of the General Aviation Airport. He said, I enjoyed showing my kids this piece of local aviation and women's history. On a somber note, this experience also made me wonder as you have, on the future of general aviation in this country. So, interesting story. Thanks, Chris, for passing that on. We've gotten so much feedback of various sorts relating to our conversation about the WASP with Sarah Rickman in episode 389. So that's it's been kind of encouraging to see the awareness raised and for people like Chris providing their stories or thoughts relating to the WASP.
Oh, and just to add on to that story, it mentioned that she was the first fatality. I looked it up quickly because I wasn't familiar with this. Turns out that not only was she the first fatality, but prior to that, she was the civilian pilot instructor who was in the air teaching somebody at Pearl Harbor, a student pilot, when the attack occurred. And so wow. If you've seen the movie Tora, 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 she was the one who was in the air. Interestingly, a local woman here in Northern California, Janet Hitt, played that role in the movie. So Janet played Cornelia Fort, who then actually was in a subsequent accident 2 years later. She was ferrying an aircraft that was struck by another pilot in the left wing, I guess. The plane she was ferrying came off, and that's why she passed away. And that was, at Long Beach, California.
Wow.
Although the accident occurred in Merkel, Texas.
Hmm. Okay. Let's see. Next we have Tom. Oh, maybe David can take this one. This is a video called The First Air Force One. This was what, David? Eisenhower's Air Force One?
Well, yeah. Columbine 2 Columbine and Columbine 2 were Eisenhower's Constellations, and they should not use the term Air Force One because at the time that call sign was not made available. They would have used standard Air Force call signs at the time. But Columbine, I actually got to see fly at Oshkosh with Savakani back in 91 or 92. I keep trying to find my photographs of the two Constellations in formation. But this is a good video about their restoring her to flight worthiness, Columbine 2. Columbine 1 is located at the National Museum of the United States Air Force in the new R&D building that will be opening in June. So she's been sitting out in the desert. They're restoring her to flight worthy condition, and I'll be happy to see her fly again.
You've mentioned that the new hangar at Dayton a couple of times, David. Are they going to have a big grand opening for that or some kind of event probably?
They are in the mid June 16th, I think.
Yeah. Maybe we should meet there.
I would, but it's the week before Smithsonian and it's the middle of the week.
Okay, that might be difficult. Well, maybe we'll have to go for a visit later.
I'm going out in the summer. My one friend and I have already made plans that we're going to...
You're one friend. You have one friend, that's it?
My friend Dave, okay. our friend Jeff, who we lost a couple years ago, his favorite place on the planet was the Air Force Museum. Ah. So since his passing, we've gone out there a couple of times to celebrate his life and the new hangar. It's not like we're not going to see everything we haven't seen before. Most of it was over in the R&D hangar and the presidential hangar. It's now just going to be on the other side of the base, so you won't have to do the bus tour. But yeah, it's a big deal for the Air Force Museum to get a fourth hangar. And so that'll be in June, and I'll as we get closer, I'll give more information for people.
Okay, good. Final item just came in from David, a different David. This is a video where someone put a camera, I guess a GoPro, on the main rotor hub of a Russian-built, what's this, an MI-8 helicopter. And it gives an incredibly intimate but dizzying view of the hodgepodge of bolts, plates, and actuators that keep a helicopter thumping away through the air. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. Thanks, David, for sending that along. I never really understood helicopters, you know, and I'm supposed to be an engineer, but I just never really got the concept of what keeps them up in the air.
Yeah, who was it that said in the the comments when that was circulating that helicopters are all fine until you lose power, then it has the aerodynamics of a pair of pliers.
Yes.
But that was hysterical.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well,
the one thing that does keep them in the air is lots of money. A lot of maintenance goes into them.
Yes, yes. Very expensive to maintain. All right. Well, I think that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest, Jack Pelton, chairman of the board for the EAA, the Experimental Aircraft Association. If you haven't yet, and probably most of you already have, you can visit their website. They're at eaa.org. You can learn more about AirVenture Oshkosh and all the activities that the EAA is involved in. Let's tell folks where they can find us online. So we'll start with Rob Mark. Where can folks find you?
Any place that has Jetwine in the name of it. Jetwine.com, Jetwine on Twitter, Jetwine on Facebook. I guess if you see me somewhere and I have a hat that says Jetwine on it, that would be a good place. And and who knows where else? At AirVenture in only, I should have known the number of days, I guess, if I was going to say that. But it's not long.
In July, right?
In July, end of July. I think it's the third week of July this year.
All right. And Brian Coleman, how do folks get in touch with you?
Oh, the best way to get a hold of me is brian@airplanegeeks.com. And I'd also like to remind our listeners, if they have any spare pennies, they could help offset the costs of getting me over to the Farnborough Air Show. And if they could go to airplanegeeks.com/Farnborough2016 and make a contribution, if they can, I would really appreciate it. I'm sorry?
And Brian, what's the name of that air show again?
Farnborough?
You know, we're already getting listener mail from our
Before you UK go, friends. Brian, will you learn to pronounce it properly?
It's the best I could do.
Wait a minute. Brian has it right. It's Farnborough. I mean, what do you guys think it is?
But that's not what he's saying. That's not what he's saying, Rob.
What's he saying? I thought that's what he said. Brian, what did you say?
I thought I said Farnborough.
See, that's what I thought he said, too.
I don't know. English isn't my first language, so I always have problems with these things.
It's got two syllables that are short, right?
Farnborough.
Farnborough. Here we go again. All right, we're going to get more mail on this. All right, so this is what you all need to do listening to this is send us a little recording. It's only got to be a few seconds, but send us a little teeny MP3 or some kind of audio recording from your phone and say Brian Coleman is going to Farnborough.
Or you could just not go to the boring civilian air show and go to the Royal Air Tattoo.
Well, there's always that. All right. Well, that one's easy to pronounce, so that's less fun. Speaking of fun, Max Trescott, one of the jolliest guys I know, at least one who flies an airplane. Where can folks find you online?
We're going to have a pronunciation lesson on Trescott. It's
yeah,
no, I'm kidding. I did a quick shout out to a gentleman from Singapore who I start to fly with tomorrow. He's an Airplane Geeks listener, and he's come to the U.S. to get his private. So we'll be working on that intensively in the Cirrus SR-20.
Oh,
so,
very cool.
Yep. Should be totally fun. Now, he's already an airline pilot. He just wants his FAA private, so it won't take as long as usual, but should be great fun. In any case, come on out and find me at Twitter, MAXTRESCOTT. I've had a lot of folks follow me in the last couple of weeks, so if you're listening, go ahead and follow me on Twitter. A lot of interesting tweets here over the last few weeks.
And David Vanderhoof, how do we find you?
You can find me if you know how to spell Vanderhoof.
It's easy to pronounce.
It's spelled exactly the way you pronounce it.
Right. Vanderhoof.
Yeah, it's pronounced Farnborough.
Exactly.
David, you have to know, there was a Vanderhoof who sat behind me in sixth grade, so I know how to spell it.
Did you say where we can find you?
Yeah, if they can know how to spell Vanderhoof, they can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof, on Facebook at David Vanderhoof. If you can spell Vanderhoof, you can find me.
Okay.
It's just like it sounds.
I think this is the longest Where Do They Find Us segment of any episode we've ever had. All right, so you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn. Look for me with David Vanderhoof. at theuavdigest.com, also on the paxxpodcast.com. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. You'll find links to all the social media places where you can find us right off of our website, as well as how to contact us. Show notes for this episode are at airplanegeeks.com/391.
Hey, and by the way, should we give a big shout out to Mr. Max T, who's going out for the, is that this week you're going out to Washington for the?
You're letting the cat out of the bag. It's true. It's true. No, that's all right. It's the selection committee for the Collier Trophy, so I'm honored to get to vote on who gets the Collier next week.
Very good. And when will that be announced?
So it'll be announced, I believe, Tuesday night, which will be the day before episode 392 releases next week.
All right.
And
what?
I was just going to say Collier. That's spelled C-O-L-L-I-E-R, and it's pronounced Farnborough.
Intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. Find his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Thanks for listening.
Keep the blue side up.
Bye.
So, guys, I think this year everybody ought to go to AirVenture. I think we should all go.
Okay, let's go.
We'll figure out a way somehow, but
there is a way.
We ought to go.
There's a way. There's a way.
Well, you know, there's that other podcast show that always...
Oh, do they show up?
Yeah, the Uncontrolled Airspace guys. They always kind of get all the glory because they're there, and we're not. So,
well, are they better than us?
No. No, in fact, they like Donald Trump, I heard.
What? Let's all show up and kick their butts.
No, you're kidding me.
I heard that all of the Uncontrolled Airspace guys are going to vote for Trump.
No, you're kidding.
You're just saying that. You're just stirring up trouble.
No. I wouldn't do that. Somebody just sent me something that I thought was kind of funny. They sent me some humor that if presidential candidates were airplanes and they related each one of them to an airplane.
Is it very long?
No. It's not at all because it...
I think you should do it now.
All right. Well, here you go. This came anonymously. If our presidential candidates in the U.S. were airplanes, Donald Trump would be a C-5. Big, noisy, no longer very useful, and obsolesced by the C-17.
But with small hands and a bad haircut.
Yeah, and a spray-on tan.
That's exactly right.
Marco Rubio would be a C-17. Doesn't carry the weight the C-5 does, but more sophisticated and fairly broadly liked. Ted Cruz would be the A-400. Not liked much at all. Troublesome. And not likely to find large appeal except in certain sectors. John Kasich is a 737-800. Universally respected, runs perfectly, offers a lot for the buck, but down deep is just kind of a ho-hum airplane. Ben Carson would be a BAE-146. Had some admirers, but quirky as all hell and long ago passed by. Now, Hillary Clinton, wait, let me just get ready for this one.
I'm nervous, Rob.
All right. Hillary Clinton would be a DC-10. You either love it or promise to never fly it again after its problems. Has tried to remain competitive by new models like the MD-11 or redesigning things, but past continues to haunt them. And Bernie Sanders, bringing up the end, not necessarily in terms of favorites, just the way this person wrote it. Bernie Sanders is a DC-9-30, not the MD-80, but the old DC-9. Consistent, but with a very narrow superiority list, and namely five abreast.
Can't really compete with the big boys these days, though. So that's kind of this person's take on if our U.S. presidential candidates were airplanes.
All right.
So we missed Carly Fiorina there. It would be something like the Comet, something that explodes at high altitude under pressure.
Maybe somebody else will come up with a few better ones.
Yeah. And there's a reason why we don't do politics on this show.